Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Make sure you never miss an episode by emailing me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Tell me what you think of the show. I love to hear from you. Okay, so this month on the TaxCast, I'm speaking with Paul Caruana Galizia, one of the sons of Malta's incredible investigative journalist and anti-corruption champion, Daphne Caruana Galizia. On the 16th of October 2017, the terrible news reached us at the Tax Justice Network and the world of her assassination. Malta is a small island nation that's long been displaying all the signs of the finance curse. State capture and corruption of democracy through an aggressive, oversized finance sector model with financial secrecy at its heart. The Caruana Galizia family has continued Daphne's relentless fight for justice, accountability and transparency, and they've done some amazing work through the Daphne Caruana Galizia Foundation. Last month, we were honoured to present the Caruana Galizia family with our Anderson Lucas Norman Award for Tax Justice Heroism. The award is named after three Jersey Islanders who were among the first to challenge the financial sector's state capture of the tax haven of Jersey. We call them the fire starters of the global tax justice movement. To find out more about their amazing story, I'll put a video in the show notes, and they're featured also in a TaxCast special on Jersey in edition number 88. I'll put all that and more in the show notes. It's a mark of how dysfunctional Malta still is that even the criminal investigation into Daphne's assassination was totally compromised. Some in the Maltese government were implicated for years in offshore shenanigans and shady deals. That government was finally brought down. Malta's richest man was charged with complicity in Daphne's murder, and the European Union's made rare interventions in what's often been dubbed the EU's pirate state. As Paul Caruana Galizia tells me here on the TaxCast, the fight for justice in Malta is far from over. I wanted to start with the culture change that happens that we have seen in many of these small island nations, which can be quite strange places. And I mean, I spent quite a lot of time in Jersey talking with people there and how finance captured their island. And one of the people living there, and actually one of the fire starters of the tax justice movement, told me that the atmosphere in terms of speaking out in Jersey became as bad as she experienced when she lived in Chile in the 1970s, which we all know was a terrible time. And, you know, anyone doubting the fear about speaking out and the dysfunction in the culture there should look into the attempts to cover up the child abuse scandal just to see how rotten the culture has got there. And they call it, maybe you have an equivalent in Malta, but in Jersey they call it the Jersey way. You know, you don't criticise. And it's hard for outsiders to understand sometimes. And I wanted to start by asking you, really, what were the early signs as finance took hold in Malta that Malta was becoming seriously compromised in terms of democracy and accountability?
I think the first thing to say about Malta is it's very small. I mean, its population, when I was growing up, was around 300,000-400,000 people. It's now doubled, but small country, small population. So on any topic, there was this culture of not sticking your neck out, not sort of criticizing the country to people outside the country, not talking ill of your neighbors, because you never know who you might end up working with or for. But then what happened with the financial sector is when it started taking up an increasingly larger share of the economy in the early 90s, I'd say it really started. This idea developed in Malta, a cross-party idea. There are many areas where the two major parties in Malta come to an agreement, but they agreed on this one thing, that whatever we do, we just do not threaten the stability of the financial sector because the economy is so dependent on it. So many Maltese people work on it. It's such a high value add sector. And so it almost became beyond criticism. You know, whatever you do, you don't threaten finance. And that only became more of a thing as the financial sector took up an increasingly larger share of the economy. Before that, it was mainly tourism. I think the moment, though, that it started affecting the country's democracy is harder to pinpoint because so much of that was obscured by the rapid economic growth. And I think this is a pattern you see in many similar places, that, you know, the economy is booming. You don't notice political issues. In many ways, actually, the politics of Malta seemed on the surface to be improving. It was becoming more liberal, more European. So it looked good at a superficial level. But there were these deeper problems that were obscured by those superficial changes. And again, the kind of more and faster the sector grew, people developed an even stronger sense that it's something you should not criticize. And very early on, people who would criticize it were seen as traitors, raining on the parade, that kind of thing. But I'd say for my mother, who had started writing, I mean, late 80s, but really she started her column in the early 90s, the really big problems became apparent, say 2013, around that point, when there was a step change, when there was a change in government, and there was this radical liberalization and deregulation of the financial sector. So I'd say that's when it became impossible or very difficult to ignore.
Yeah, and I know that the realities for ordinary people of finance kind of taking over in that way are really quite profound. And I mean, I know from Jersey that the cost of living really shot up. All these glass-fronted buildings started being constructed. I spend a lot of time in Sicily, and which has its own problems and dysfunctions, as does Britain.
Yes.
But a lot of Sicilians look on Malta as kind of the rich neighbour. Lots of my friends, you know, they've tried to find work in the gambling industry there, work as builders. And a good friend of ours moved there with his family in desperation. He didn't want to leave, but he was struggling so much to find work in Sicily. And eventually he moved back from Malta. He told us how much you have to pay for a kilo of tomatoes, for example, you know, and he actually found it a less bad option to return to live in Sicily, even though he struggles every day to find enough work, because it's just such an expensive place to live.
It's really interesting to hear that from the Sicilian side, because we see it, you know, Maltese wages have risen above Sicilian ones, and so you see a lot of immigration, and there are loads of Sicilian restaurants, cafes, all the rest of it. But your description is exactly right. Over the past 10 years, house prices, for example, relative to incomes, have really rocketed. The prices of groceries, food at restaurants have all rocketed. When I go there now, I find it expensive. So, you know, I moved to London in 2009, and at that point, Malta was so much cheaper, you know. Most people could afford a place to live. Food was really cheap at restaurants. And over the period since then, prices have really converged. I'd say a lot of Maltese restaurants are now charging prices at the kind of London level. In parts of the country that are very popular among people who work in iGaming, we call it, so these online gaming companies, which in themselves, and now I think, account for something like between 10 and 15% of our GDP. I mean, I think of it as part of the finance sector, really. I mean, it bears many of the same characteristics, at least as the sector works in Malta. So places where people work in iGaming live are extremely expensive. So St. Julian, Slema. Slema is where I first live. historically was always a little bit more expensive, but now is just unaffordable to people of my generation, to people in their early 30s, late 20s. So in short, yes, there has been a really dramatic change in the country's wage structure. There's a lot of inequality now. Because, of course, over this period, it's not like the wages of doctors have increased, or teachers, or police officers, really. But there's now this class of people who can pay what I think are ridiculous sums of money for flats or small houses or whatever.
Yeah, it's really turbocharged inequality. I mean, we've seen that in Bermuda, at Jersey, many, many places. And we've often talked about in the Tax Justice Network a plan B for small island nations to be able to get off this kind of path dependency on finance. There are different solutions for different locations that have their own difficulties. But, you know, we've seen things like farming and tourism sectors suffering as finance kind of eats everything. How would you see Malta diversifying economically to try to move away from this huge finance sector model?
I think the interesting thing is, around the time I left Malta, tourism, I think, accounted for about a quarter of our GDP, so a huge sector. And there were all these very valid arguments against tourism becoming an even bigger part of our economy based on its resource-intensive nature. You know, you need a lot of water. The country just can't sustain a million people every summer. It's ridiculous. We can't keep building these enormous hotels. But the kind of even more valid arguments that perhaps the solution is shifting towards more sustainable tourism, so not mass tourism, but, you know, what in Sicily they might call agriturismo, things like that, it never really took hold. And I think it can and should, and we have a history and tradition of it. I think finance can also be rebalanced in other ways. So Malta is, you know, it's part of the European Union. It uses English as an official and an increasingly important language. So historically, we've been quite an important center for education at different levels. I think there are attempts to kind of develop some technology. I mean, it's a really difficult question because a policymaker has to tell the country, look, I know the financial sector has been an enormous success, but actually, I think, you know, and there's no politician in Malta who's gonna do that. It's going to take a lot, I think, for the electorate to start recognizing the huge problems. Interestingly, that may be happening in a really circuitous way. So Malta's seen a real lot of development over the past 10 years. So the coast around those places I mentioned, St. Julian's and Slimma, is all high-rise apartment blocks. Your Sicilian friend might have told you this, but the country feels like it's permanently under construction. It is unbearable. You know, roads blocked, cranes everywhere, the air is thick with dust. Everything's covered in concrete, noise all the time. It's a really deeply unpleasant place to live. And, you know, that's happening because of a mixture of things, bad planning, a lot of corruption in the planning process. But because the country just went down this very aggressive hyper-financialization, hyper-development route with an aim to one day become like Dubai. You know, like a hyper-financialized, hyper-globalized city-state. And it's the kind of consequences of that overdevelopment that will push people away from that model, I sense. And I find that really interesting because there hasn't been in Malta a very strong environmental movement. The Green Party never once won a seat in parliament, for example. But now there is this growing awareness that this really matters. We can't keep living like this. It matters to our health. Our living standards have really deteriorated. And I think that's forcing a debate on these deeper issues.
That's good, and it's not an easy answer. Certainly, I used to live in Costa Rica, which pursued a very an eco-tourism kind of model, which can very fairly be criticised for many things, but I always find it fascinating to compare Costa Rica's tourism model with Sicily, actually, because they have around the same population size, and yet they've not developed those types of, you know, it would certainly need more visionary thinking, and I think a lot of that tends to come from younger generations. But I wanted to ask you about your mother's work. Given the atmosphere, we know how difficult it is in some of these small islands in Malta, of how incredibly toxic the environment was that she was working in. What drove her to be so brave in that environment?
I think, to kind of rewind a bit, the period in which she started writing, there were no women writing newspaper columns or even reporting really straightforward news stories. Malta had emerged from this period of quite heavy state repression of the press, of a lot of parts of society and the economy. And so newspapers continued this tradition of carrying columns and news reports without bylines. So she was actually the first newspaper columnist to use their own name, and she was the first woman to write one. What drove her, I think, because she was so young, right? She was in her early 20s. I think in part it was, frankly, I think naivety. She really thought, this is it, Malta's changing, let's do away with all this rubbish. It's ridiculous that people have to write anonymously. I just don't accept it. It was that kind of boldness, you know, when you're young, you might have. And once she set it, you know, it opened up the culture of newspaper writing quite a lot, of reporting a lot. She grew up in that period where it was very difficult to travel. Country was very poor. There was a high rate of illiteracy. The church was very powerful, and she found it very oppressive, very, very oppressive. But her parents used to subscribe to foreign magazines, and she kind of grew up reading them. And she always wondered why the countries she read about in these magazines were so different to Malta, why the writing was so different, because she had, in a way, no access to it. She decided, you know, when I'm working, I want to change things. I want to live in a completely different country. And I don't want my children. So she had my two brothers and me when she was very young as well. By the time she was 25, we were all born. And she said, I don't want them to grow up in the same way that I did. And the momentum just kept building, you know, once she did away with anonymity, once she came over the prejudice against women writing, it just kept building and building and building, and she just became more and more of a force. And a lot of it is just down to her personality. You know, she was a very, very determined person, had total conviction in what she thought was right, and wasn't easily swayed at all. I think a lot comes down, you need to be very strong. Because there was this culture in Malta of not speaking badly, at least publicly, about anyone. To do the job that she did, you really had to be your own person. You really couldn't be the kind of person who worries what people might think of you, who worries about bumping into someone you've criticized. Because that used to happen all the time, right? I remember growing up, we'd go to a restaurant, and there'd be the subject of one of her columns sitting at the table next to us. relatives of the drug trafficker she was reporting on in our class. It was just how things were in Malta. And you really had to say, no, I'm not going to adapt. I'm not going to fall into that mold. I'm going to break it and keep breaking.
It's so interesting that she was the first woman, as you say, and she was such a trailblazer in that way. And I've often thought a lot of what she was fighting is a kind of a male-driven sociopathic culture that seems to pervade some of these big finance sector, you know, the city in London. It all seems, I don't want to overstate it, but it does seem like a very masculine kind of culture.
There is a real culture of misogyny in Malta. I mean, violent, ugly misogyny. That was terrible when she first started out, which is when people started calling her a witch, you know, this ancient, super misogynistic insult, and would actually say things like burn her, burn the witch. And that carried on, right? It carried on literally to the day she died and after. You know, it was really like a long witch hunt, her life. And that kind of seeped into public life in Malta, the way government officials, MPs spoke about her was really vile, really misogynistic. And in the media as well, and of course in finance and various other economic sectors. And whatever government officials, especially later, criticized her for, they always brought in the misogyny. It was always there, always.
Yeah, and in terms of the Daphne Foundation that your family set up, obviously it is still not safe for whistleblowers and journalists and people, women, who want to speak yes. out today. Why did you set that up, the Daphne Foundation? I mean, what do you hope to be bringing about? I mean, obviously, there's a terrible story about the complicity and the, in terms yes. of even the criminal investigation was completely compromised. But again, this dysfunctional nature of things in Malta.
So we set it up quietly in the summer of 2018, really as a vehicle to carry on the campaigning that my family had been doing from the murder onwards, and also to promote my mother's work and to secure her legacy, which is still, you know, it's always under attack, her credibility, the credibility of her work, and also just to more broadly shift the culture away from secrecy and silence, away from the idea that corruption has always been part of Maltese public life and will always be part of it, just to shift things completely, and also to support and promote investigative journalism, the kind my mother was doing. I mean, really, the focus more recently has been on fighting the legal cases. So, you know, there are criminal proceedings against a number of men in Malta. There was a public inquiry that recently concluded but hasn't yet reported. And there are a number of constitutional cases. And so most of our resources as the foundation have been dedicated to this legal work. In the longer term, we'll broaden out to supporting, doing more supportive work for journalism organizations. So it's run by Matthew, my eldest brother, was a journalist himself and worked on the Panama Papers. And one of the projects he did, for example, through a grant, was set up an investigative journalism center, which allowed Malta's main dailies to collaborate for the first time on a project they called the Passport Papers, which was based on a leak from the private firm Henley & Partners that had the sole concession to sell Maltese passports. So in the long term, the plan is to do a lot more work like that. But right now we're in the thick of all the legal cases.
Right. I know certainly in the UK, they're planning to remove the public interest defence, the whistleblowing, which could put reporters in jail. I know the EU whistleblower legislation is not perfect, but it's a lot stronger. But I do know Malta has, you know, had this huge decline in the Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index. There's still such a lot of work to do. And in terms of the European Union, You know, you mentioned the passports, the sale, there's mafia and oligarch money, huge frauds, corrupt government that did eventually get brought down. But in terms of the European Union dealing with, you know, a criminogenic EU member state, how do you feel that that kind of support has...
The strange thing is this, that I think if we were from a less surprising country, say a post-Soviet state, and we went to the EU and said, oh, this has happened, we would have been less effective. And I think the thing about Malta is for so long it flew under the radar. And when we first started campaigning across Europe, and we really started really a few days after the murder. Why? Because we realized, looking around us, almost every national institution was compromised in the sense that we knew there were individuals within those institutions, say the anti-money laundering agency, the police force, the AG, who were honest, capable, and very determined, but they were overpowered because the way Malta is set up constitutionally is almost everything, including large chunks of the judiciary, is answerable and controlled by the Prime Minister's office. So we said, we have to look outside for justice. And thank God we were EU members, right? And Council of Europe members, because where else would we have gone? We would have been totally stranded. And when we got there, we realized people had no idea. People had no idea what had been going on in Malta for the past, say, 5 whatever years. And so it shocked them, and in a way shocked them into action. And that's good and bad. It's bad because it means they weren't really monitoring the country, and they let it run so long that it got to the point of car bombings. Good in that it meant their response within, you know, the constraints that exist was quite strong. So the European Parliament sent a number of delegations, really put pressure on the Commission to act. The Commission did act in a number of important respects and you know, came down on the Maltese government privately and publicly. And we knew that the campaign was all about that, basically, using external levers on Malta. Another good thing about Malta, unlike, say, Turkey or Russia, is because it's so small, international relations are really important. Malta can't just say, whatever, we don't care what Europe thinks, because we really need European Union membership. So these levers are quite powerful. An important point came when we learned of this mechanism at the Council of Europe that allows the Council to assign a special rapporteur to individual cases. So we lobbied, you know, in the same way, bizarrely, that a tobacco company might lobby for something. We were running around assembly members, asking them to support this motion for a rapporteur. And, you know, long story short, the parliamentary assembly assigned one. He investigated my mother's case for a long time, wrote a very damning report, called for a public inquiry under the threat of sanctions. And so we got one. And, you know, over 2 years, it was all about that. What levers can we use, not just in Europe, really everywhere, from the US to everywhere, to just open up a space in Malta for those individuals I mentioned earlier to be able to work without political interference. And, you know, we finally managed. At least we managed to get to a point where people were arrested and charged.
Yes, thank goodness. Thank goodness for that. On the one hand, there is Malta and other jurisdictions with kind of similar problems. On the other hand, Malta is only possible because of the global financial secrecy architecture that small island nations like Malta do feed into, and they're all connected with. One Italian professor I interviewed years ago told me, we were talking about Berlusconi and his tax dodging, and he said to me, look, he's not our Berlusconi, he's your Berlusconi, you know, because he wouldn't be able to do what he did. The mafia wouldn't be able to do what they do without the City of London and these financial systems that are globally open for corrupt money. And, you know, Malta is just a part of a much bigger puzzle. I mean, how do you see that in terms of what needs to happen?
I think the analysis really fits Malta, right? And the amazing thing about my mother's career is that she went from reporting on domestic corruption, which at the time was, say, a corrupt judge, a corrupt MP, corrupt prime minister, to almost imperceptibly reporting on globalized corruption, you know, from reporting of bribery at a level of, say, 20,000 euros to reporting on bribery of tens of millions of euros, which, you know, my mother at the end of the day was a freelancer from Maltese Daily. And that is a extraordinary shift and level of pressure to deal with. And like you say, it was made possible ultimately because of secret companies, right? Because of anonymous shell companies are really the key. The Panama Papers leak that kind of cracked this wall of secrecy that she kept hitting at, until the crack opened up, letting in more light, say, that she could suddenly see what was happening behind the wall. And the moment, it's amazing that the moment she really got, she got there, right? She got to the final company and she said, this is it. I just need to find the name. She was murdered. And the person who murdered her made the calculation that there was only one person who could have got the name of the company, and now she's dead. I had her murdered, so I'm safe. But through another series of accidents, he was found out. But that's, you know, that the murder was to protect the secret. The shell companies are to protect the secrets of massive corruption. What needs to be done about it? My view is really straightforward. That the privacy arguments for anonymous shell companies, if they're even valid, are far outweighed by the public interest arguments against them. And I just don't think they should exist anywhere in any form. But before we get there, I think there are serious reforms that need to be made of the sectors that we call enablers, the accountants, the lawyers, the fixers. I think it's crazy that they can open up shell companies for politicians and oligarchs in this way, and we're somehow meant to say, hey, that's their job. I just think that's unacceptable. I think on the official response to it, there are real deficiencies in how national authorities like financial intelligence units and other anti-money laundering agencies share information and collaborate on investigations. And, you know, we're talking about really globalized transnational crime here. You know, we need a system of enforcement that is as globalized as the crime it's trying to fight.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
The one thing I'll say, Naomi, is at least in Malta's case, the story is far from over. A lot of the changes that need to happen in the country have yet to happen. My mother's case is still ongoing. Journalists still operate in a highly threatening environment. But the country, if we grow out of this, rather than end up suffering even more from it, will, we hope, provide an example to a lot of other jurisdictions around the world that find themselves stuck in this trap where they think corruption will always be with them, that they will never grow out of this financial sector dominance. I hope that we'll emerge from this as a positive example against those issues.
I hope so too, yeah.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Paul Caruana Galizia on the TaxCast. To find out more about the work of the Daphne Caruana Galizia Foundation, go to www.daphne.foundation. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.